Welcome to the American Shakespeare Center's Blackfriars Backstage Pass, The Fair Maid of the West, part of the ASC's 2010 fall season. We hope you enjoy this backstage look at the ASC's production of Thomas Heywood's The Fair Maid of the West, now playing on the stage of the American Shakespeare Center's Blackfriars Playhouse in Stanton, Virginia.
Hello, welcome to the backstage pass for the American Shakespeare Center production of The Fair Maid of the West, or The Girl Worth Gold, which is one of the five plays running currently in our 2010 fall season. I am Aaron Hohalter, the assistant director and stage manager, and I'm filling in today for Ralph Allen Cohen. I'm here with four of the actors in our resident troupe, and I will let them introduce themselves and the characters they are playing.
Hi, my name is Patrick Midgley, and I play Spencer.
Hi, my name is Jenna Hoban, and I play Bess Bridges.
Hi, everybody. My name is James Keegan, and I play Ruffman.
Hi, I'm Allison Glenzer, and I play Clem.
Great. Welcome, everyone. Let's start with just a standard question that seems like everyone wants to know anytime we're not doing a Shakespeare play, which is, how is working on this play different than working on a Shakespeare play? How do you approach the text differently? Is your approach to building the characters at all different? What do you think?
Well, the similarities, I think, are behind the characters, and that whether it's Shakespeare or anybody, to build a character kind of requires the same thing from me anyway. So that part isn't so different. I think the biggest difference has to do with the language, because Shakespeare has proven himself to be superior in the writing department. And we know this, it's something that I think we take for granted because he's become such a huge influence on writing and playwriting in particular. So we know about iambic pentameter, and we know that there are other rhetorical devices that he uses, but it's not until you approach another playwright that you see it in contrast how superior Shakespeare is. And then that's not to say that the other playwrights aren't worth doing, because they absolutely are. But for me, learning the language is so much easier with Shakespeare because of the alliteration, the assonance, and these particular rhetorical, some very specific rhetorical devices that I can lom onto when I'm memorizing. And then, and they're also, those are character driven. So when it's another playwright, I think I'm latching on to different things. It's less, it takes a little bit more effort to just hang on to those words. And then once the memorization process is over, then I find that rehearsing the plays is not that different than rehearsing a Shakespeare play.
I agree with Jenna. Jenna started working because she has such a massive amount of just work in this play. I mean, so many lines. But so we started early together as well, working on some stuff, because there were certain scenes where I did not understand what I was saying. And not in, I mean, in Shakespeare way, It's exciting. His jokes stand the test of time. We just did a podcast about Henry, and Falstaff's a funny guy. I mean, and some of my jokes, I was like, I don't even know what these things mean. And we had to sort of decide with each other what we were talking about. And that doesn't necessarily happen with Shakespeare, but they were so antiquated and so kind of clumsy, not to put down the playwright. That was an interesting thing where we kind of had to do a little more work to map out the playwriting, which I don't really have to do with Shakespeare.
Although I think there are times where you have to do the same thing with Shakespeare. You know, I think there are times where there are things like in Twelfth Night, you know, is it like to take dust like Mistress Moll's picture? And
oh,
we
yeah.
have no idea what Mistress Moll's picture is, or what Toby Belch is talking about, or, you know, what Olivia is talking about at moments, you know. So there are things that are topical and references that are topical, and they're not going to carry the same kind of humor, you know, necessarily today. Although,
that's
depending
true.
On how we, as long as we, I think, arrive at an understanding of them, we can deliver that a lot of times.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that there are moments like that in Shakespeare. You may be right that there are more in Fair Maid, but I think they're present in Shakespeare too. It's just that some of us have done those plays so many times that it ceases to be foreign to us.
Yeah, that's probably even more true.
So this time around, the play being so new, you know, not really knowing it and not knowing a way around it or having seen it, ever. You know, it's got a different kind of newness to it. Certainly Clem, though, has a lot of topical jokes, you know, being a serving man and, yeah. and interacting.
And that's kind of a delight, too, about these two, both this play and Wild Oats in our season. At least for me, confidentially, I mean, there's a lot of, because the Shakespeare canon is so completely well known, that it's kind of fun to really take ownership of a play that people don't know quite as well, and to feel like this play and this role is something that you really possess
so maybe
entirely.
Not so much baggage attached to it.
Yeah, yeah. There's not that pressure of having seen, you know, every production and going over films and reading the Variorum and, you know, all this information. Whereas when we work on like Fair Maid and Wild Oats, there's only a few productions you can find, and you can have fun kind of making it a little bit more your own in some ways.
Is it in any way easier to, like, is there anything about working on this play that was easier than working on a Shakespeare play, or is Shakespeare just giving you so many more things that it's always easier to work on a Shakespeare play? Or
no, I think what Patrick said does, I think that applies for me too. I think that I felt liberated to make the character, to make choices. I felt liberated because it didn't feel like there were expectations on what Best Bridges is, because most people that have come to see this play had never seen a Best Bridges before, so felt at liberty. And that's just a wonderful thing for a creative process, to feel free. Also, I think, I don't know if this makes it easier or not, but there's something about this plot that is different than the other plots that we're working with this season. Othello comes to mind in particular, that there are so many sort of emotional levels to that play. And I don't know that I feel that as much with The Fair Maid of the West. What I feel is a simpler plot. Now, there is one section when Sarah Fallon comes on as the chorus and describes this enormous section of the plot as the chorus. We don't see that thing happen on stage, which I think Shakespeare does that occasionally, but it's right there in the, you know, final quarter of the play. You have one character come out and tell everybody, oh, this is what you're missing.
And start the speech with that our stage isn't good enough to do what needs to be done, so yeah. She'll have to describe it.
Yeah.
Which is just interesting.
Which is really interesting. And outside of that, you know, we do have sort of this battle that happens on the ship. You know, we have these other sort of magnificent things that happen, but in the end, at the end of the night, it does feel to me like the plot is, it's one line to follow. We have more, you know, we have groups of characters, and we get to follow each character's journey, but it doesn't feel like the same sort of levels that we would get in something like Othello, for instance. And I think Wild Oats is like that. So there, to say simple, I think detracts from this play's greatness, but that seems to be the best term for it. There's something simpler about this particular plot than the other ones that we're doing this season.
Sure.
I would talk about this play's goodness, but I would never talk about its greatness. It's a good play. Audiences like it. They have a great time at it, but I don't think of it as a great play, and I think part of it has to do with that simplicity. It is also worth noting that in Hamlet, in Act 5, there's an entire description by Hamlet of what took place to him in Act 4 aboard a ship with pirates.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, it's not unheard of in Shakespeare to have things like that happen as well. But, I mean, my character, for instance, in Ruffman in Fair Maid of the West is a sidebar. This character and his presence is a sidebar. He has very little interaction with the main plot. He doesn't have a whole lot to do with Spencer. He doesn't even meet Spencer until the end. He doesn't even know what's going on with Spencer.
Nor do we know who
he's just Amulus Gloriosus. He's a braggart, a coward, and he has to be shown up for what he is. And he's turned into somebody brave, but he's not particularly important to the plot. He's just this little sidebar of entertainment. And I think comedies can have that kind of thing. They can drop that in there, and you get to have that, and it's fun, and it's important for Bess because she's going to dress up as a boy later and be brave and lead men and everything like that. And so she gets to do this little dress-up moment before, and the audience gets to enjoy it because she embarrasses the guy on stage, and it's great fun. You know, anytime you get to drop your pants on stage, it's great fun. May not be fun for the audience, but it's fun for me. So, you know, I mean, I think that the play has wonderful turns like that, and has the flavor of comedy. I think Wild Oats has a lot of similarity to that too. The plot is more complex, but even the complexity of the plot becomes part of the joke as it gets explained in that play. You know, and that's, I think it says a lot about what people come to comedy for. And if you think of Comedy of Errors or Shakespeare's, you know, early comedies particularly, they have that flavor too of ridiculousness. I think though you get to a play like Twelfth Night, and there's nobody in Twelfth Night who's not there for a reason and doesn't weave into the main plot, importantly, including like Antonio, who's in love with Sebastian, whether it's, you know, whatever kind of love he has for him, he's in love with him, he cares about him, and he gets hurt in that play when Sebastian finds love somewhere else, and, you know, so everybody in the play is affected by loss and love. But I think Jenna's right. I think this play has a more straightforward quality, and I think it's one of the things that audiences love about it, that it has a kind of straightforward, direct quality to it, and you know what you're getting, you know.
And I think that what you said about comedy, I get excited about this play in its sort of basis in commedia. I think that there's a braggadocio, there's a clown, there's these archetypes of comedy that are really fun to just get to play with that simple plot. When there's something gorgeous about Othello, because it's about a universal theme of jealousy and watching how that crumbles individuals and people. So it stands the test of time because of that emotion. But there's something about standing the test of time in getting to really watch the physicality and specificity of a braggadocio or of a clown. And that's what I love about doing
and
this.
And that's
play.
Why those types exist. I mean, people keep coming to comedy, not for, they're not looking for novelty. They're looking to see the same types.
And you can see it
that's
still.
That's why comedia is still.
Right. You can see it in a Scooby Doo cartoon, or you can see it on Friends, you know, but those types have withstood time. And I love that this play allows just those to be very, very cleanly seen. Is how I agree with Jenna's.
All right, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, this seems like a great time to talk about Ruffman and Clem, who are both just delightful characters to watch. So, one of the most fun scenes in this play is this scene when Bess bests Ruffman, and you've already alluded to it, James. So, would you tell us a little bit about what that scene is and how you and Jenna and Jim, the director, how you put that together, how do you decide on what that scene actually is? It's such a fun scene. I just want to hear a little bit more about it.
I think one of the first building blocks of that scene was that, our audience is going to be looking at a female actor dressed up like a boy, and they're going to know. They know, and Bess tells the audience in her entrance who she is and that she is dressed up. But then after that, when Ruffman comes on stage, I have to drop the fact that I'm acting a boy, and I have to truly play the action of the scene to shame him. And one of my memories of rehearsing this scene is both Jim Warren, the director, and James Keegan, my fellow actor, encouraging me to literally hit harder when I hit him, and but also figuratively, you have to really do it. You know, the audience knows that you are pretending to be a boy, but you have to really be going for it and shaming him. So it was, it's a great acting lesson for anybody that you must always play true to the action. You're not pretending to play the action. You must do it. And from there, I think we were able to have even more fun with it once it felt. It was coming from a truer place, and I remember thinking like, oh, I don't know, I just, that feels so mean. Well, it should feel mean. Like, we've got to get something out of him. I've got to get a reaction out of him, you know. And you know, James is not a little man. He's not going to be afraid of
I'm a great big guy.
So I think it paints a great picture for the audience to see a little person intimidating a larger person, and they know that it's a woman dressed up like a man, and he gets to be, and Ruffman gets to be duped. So it's a lot of fun for them to be in on Bess's secret. Inside of that, though, I think one of the important things was us finding the truth of it, that she really has a bone to pick with him. There is a legitimate reason for doing this, and she wants to see some change in his behavior. And so with that as a foundation, then I think it became even more fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a scene, it's a corrective, you know. It's he's been causing upheaval in the house that she runs, the tavern inn that she runs, the windmill, and he lords it over her servants, and he's a great, great big bully, and bullies need to get their comeuppance, and they need to get their comeuppance in no uncertain terms. You know, and if anybody's ever, you know, if you've ever faced down a bully, you know this, that they're ready to crumble, you know, and it's the thing that so often people who are bullied don't realize, that if they just stood up, that the bully would crumble. And Ruffman crumbles. But one, my favorite memory from the rehearsal is that, and it just goes to show you the difference between page and stage. You know, this is the fifth play that we're getting to. You know, I had read it. I had read the part. I had memorized the part to varying degrees of successfulness by the time we were in rehearsal. And there's a scene where I'm embarrassed. She takes my sword. She asks for my sword, and I have to give it up. And then she, dressed as a boy, he tells me to shine his shoe, and I do that. It says, shine that shoe. And I assumed, reading it on the page, that it meant the shoe that she's wearing. Right, shine her shoe. You shine somebody else's shoes. That's humiliating. That made sense. The next thing that got said in the speech was untie that point. You know, and I was like, okay, she wants me to do something else on her costume because I just did something on her costume. But we're in rehearsal, and Jenna has the sword, and she points to the points that would have been on my belt as Ruffman, and I thought, oh. So I just had this light bulb moment. I thought, how much better is that? I have to untie my own pants, and they will, of course, fall down. And suddenly, you're in an entirely different level of humiliation. It made so much more sense. But I had read through the thing a number of times. That never occurred to me, because the logic of the page dictated what she's asked me to do. She's asked me to do another version of that, the same thing. So at some point that she has, you know, and then she walks on me. Which was great fun.
Which also, I think, is another...
I also did push-ups with her on my back.
Yes, James did push-ups with me on his back, which I think is one of the great... This is a great visual picture for our audience to see me standing on James's back, because on one level they know she can't possibly be hurting that man. He did, in fact, do push-ups with me, so I know I'm not hurting him. I know he can handle it, but it's still humiliating.
I really like it.
It's still a humiliating position for him to be in. So although they know on some level that the actor is not being hurt, they can enjoy it maybe even more to see that humiliation.
Yeah, and they seem to have a good time in that moment. Oh,
yeah.
Of me.
Yeah, it's such a fun...
It's a crowd pleaser.
It's such a fun scene. It's such a fun moment. I hope everybody gets a chance to see it. And you're right, James, it is a really interesting lesson about the difference between reading a play and staging a play, and that, like,
well, and the interaction
moment,
of an actor, another actor gives you something, you're like, huh, you just clarified everything for me. Thank you very much.
In that moment, there's no stage direction that say, and then his pants fall down,
exactly.
And he has funny boxer shorts underneath. But but with the, you know, when you actually do it, you know, in rehearsal, you realize, oh, that's an opportunity for something really excellent and fun and funny. So, yeah, what a fantastic scene. Another super fun scene is after that, when Ruffman has now decided to change his ways and prove that he's gallant, and the script calls for a sword fight, and the stage directions are enter Clem and the sailors on one side, at the other, Ruffman, who draws upon them and beats them off. And that's the entire scene. No... And then the next scene is in a different place. Enter Bess, Clem, and sailors, and then they're having a conversation about this fight that just happened. So I also want to hear a little bit about, with just that bit of stage direction, how you and the other actors and our fight choreographer Colleen Kelly came up with what we actually ended up with.
Yeah.
So if you two could tell us a bit about that.
I think we probably could. Just so you understand, after Ruffman is embarrassed by Bess then reveals that she was the one that embarrassed him and embarrasses him further, and this makes for the alteration in him. He decides that, look at the way I've been humiliated, and like so many people don't, he actually seeks to learn from the humiliation and change. So it's a wonderful part of the play that he actually does change as a result of this. He gets taught his lesson, but he learns his lesson. And then he's more courageous in fights. So it was that's where the fight comes from. It's to show that his courage has shifted. I don't know. This is so it's so hard to trace how this fight got built. You know,
I will say there was a moment in rehearsal where earlier in the thing where already Ruffman has roughed Clem up. Mm-hmm. And I have to enter back in to deliver news. And I decided that I wanted a colander on my head and be protecting myself with some other kitchen implement. Like I had been in the kitchen and to protect myself. Those then became some of the weapons in that of whatever, when the fight came about, that those were the weapons. So I think we knew the fight's humor. And that he would somehow be an amazing, it would be an amazing fighting event, but it would have humor always still in it.
And that's what Jim wanted. The director wanted.
Exactly.
He wanted it to have that kind of quality.
So we knew that that was the quality that was going to happen. And so then whenever it's getting built, when you have the flavor, when you know what the flavor is, then the components build from that, from knowing the flavor.
And Colleen Kelly's our fight director, and Ben Kearns is our fight captain. So they're people who are really experienced with fights. And, and Colleen's great at using what's to hand in the scene, you know, what's there and making something out of that. So we had this frying pan. So that becomes an essential part of the scene.
Yeah.
It gets transferred from one person to another. And
it's then, incredible to watch what they do with the frying pan, you know, but it's
then,
like you have that found, you have that object. And
right.
So then things, the creativity of the people in the room feed off of whatever's sort of specific in the...
And there's a moment where I jump a sword swipe, and that sort of came out of my desire in that moment. I was heading in that direction. I said, how about if he swipes at me and I jump over it? So I know that piece came from what I want to do in the moment. And Colleen said, yeah, we can do that. And then, you know, then she's responsible for how do I get to the next piece.
Mm-hmm.
And she choreographed a lot of that. And there's another time where I wanted to have an opportunity. I had an opportunity to hit somebody or swipe at them with a sword. And I said, how about I just... breathe on them with my bad breath, and so that's there's a moment of that in there, but all the pieces come from everybody in a way, and the style
Ben,
comes from everybody.
Ben knew he wanted to do a song in one of the interludes that's really a specific memory for a lot of people of our generation, and so that song, I don't want to, do we give it away on a podcast? I guess they have to like be cool people. It's, you know, the best around from Karate Kid. And so they were already rehearsing it. And I said in a rehearsal, oh my God, wouldn't it be awesome if that played during the fight? Because it's all about that. And Jim liked it. And Ben was willing and excited to do that. So that built on the idea that was already present.
Right, yeah.
But also, you know, so much comes from, from the people watching you, the people you're fighting with, of course, give one piece of the flavor by how they do what they do and how they respond. But then you really count on the people who are watching the fight to fine-tune the flavor of it and to tell you, give you suggestions about what you should be doing, how it reads. It's very hard to know how a lot of that reads unless you've done a lot of it. And I've done some fighting, but not a lot. And I, you know, so it's nice to have someone out there like Ben and like Colleen who can tell you how it's reading and what the flavor is and give you, and they're both actors too, so they know. They know how you deliver that idea, too. They can give you suggestions that are really great within the fight. Because the fight, you know, is built on the choreography and the pieces, but the pieces don't come alive until you get that story in there, too, mm-hmm. and the flavor. And they're so wonderfully responsible to the story, to getting the narrative in there and reminding us that we have to enjoy it. And, you know, that if we enjoy it, that it becomes a different type of thing.
Well, the audience certainly enjoys it. I mean, what a great fight. It's super fun. And part of the reason it's so fun is because Clem, our clown in this piece, gets to be part of it and is a pretty big part of the fight. Clem is, I mean, truly a delightful character. And so I just want to know, Allie, you mentioned a little bit about the commedia in this piece. And is that where you got your inspiration from, or did you... also pull from other things? Just tell us a little bit about this guy and how he compares maybe to some other clowns, because you've played a lot of clowns in your career.
Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about
I do.
Him.
I don't... He's weird. I love this little man. But I did definitely draw physically and sort of just in this way that Jenna's talked about the sort of the simplicity, I found that it's very simple. He loves Bess. He works for her, and he goes on this journey. Like, so the to fill him in physically and emotionally, I used a lot of commedia and clown, and worked from those positions and in how he turns and how he moves. I went back to that training from school. And then I just have a lot of, I came up with the idea of this guy, if the humor was a little hard for me to understand, that he found himself delightful. that what if those jokes were, instead of pushing them to be funny, what if they are already the funniest jokes ever written? And he's just a man who's maybe just not quite in his time. So he finds himself absolutely hilarious.
And he does laugh a lot at his own jokes.
Oh my gosh, he thinks
really great.
But it's not like, oh, I'm so funny. It's like, that joke was so funny. That word was so funny.
I really enjoy it,
but like that moment was just awesome, wasn't it? So like everything is just awesome. So this started from there. Was like, I don't understand that joke. I bet it, and we, Jen and I joked at my house one night. It was like, I bet back then Clem killed. And that was just a funny thing we said in my living room. But then it sort of grew from there, like flowered from there. It was like, wait, what if Clem is always killing? You know, he's just always killing him. So, and himself. So that, and then his exuberance could really shine. And, you know, so I just sort of find him that he's always being delighted.
Nice.
And so it's very fun to play, always being delighted.
Yeah, so you said that...
Oh, and then Jim Belushi. Belushi in Animal House was the other. Like, Belushi in Animal House
John
also...
Belushi.
I mean, sorry, John Belushi. John Belushi in Animal House also dresses up as a pirate to do something and has a long speech. I asked if they could sing behind me because there's music behind John Belushi when he's trying to... you know, raise up the frat house to feel better.
Do his big inspiration.
Yeah, so Belushi and Commedia.
Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl
Harbor? Germans? Don't forget it, he's on a roll.
So you mentioned how much Clem just loves Bess, mm-hmm. and that seems to be a theme throughout the play. This is that everybody just loves mm-hmm. Bess. She is the girl worth gold, as it were. And so... I want to know, what is it specifically about this girl? And Patrick, I'll let you talk about this first, since you play Spencer, who is the romantic lead and her opposite. What is it about this girl that just makes everyone love her?
Well, I think that's a good question. And that kind of sets up, it kind of sets up the whole relationship between Bess and Spencer, is that it begins, in fact, Spencer, all we know about Spencer, he comes out and says... he's in search of honor. He's willing to go lay down his life for honor, and that he is also infatuated with this young woman who is beneath his social status. And class is a very important element of their relationship. They're both aware of it, and they both try and overcome it in the early phase of their relationship. But it's in fact when Spencer defends her honor at the tavern where she works, and in so doing commits an atrociously dishonorable act by killing a man in a bar fight, that this relationship and the stakes of this relationship are raised so high that they go from, you know, the first little thing you see Bess and Spencer do is kind of do a little waltz and they twirl each other around and it's this nice flirtation. But then they have this scene on the bluff after the murder, and all of a sudden they're both willing to say, no matter what happens for the rest of our lives, we'll be committed and faithful to each other, and we'll find a way to find each other again. And there's a great deal of truth in that sometimes the world has to get in the way for you to realize what it is you really want. And so in that sense, I think it's a very simple relationship. They've kind of fallen for each other at the bar, but then something tremendous happens, and these normal people are put in this extraordinary situation, and they have to cover the whole globe to find each other again. And that's the appeal of the story.
I think it was the Last of the Mohicans moment.
Yeah.
If you ever saw that movie, it's like, stay alive. No matter what occurs, I will find you.
So, now it also seems like that's kind of the motivating factor of this play is the love that you two have for each other. So, Bess, what is it about Spencer that really is, that she falls in love with?
He's so darn good looking. I think
that is true. He does have massive biceps.
I don't know. That's a really good question. He's such sort of her Prince Charming in the play that it would be really easy to just to say that he's dashing and of higher status. But I think that we have to believe that in the pre-plot, you know, the backstory that we don't necessarily get to read, we have to invent, that they just have a true love, that they have a love, you know, maybe even at first sight, but we have to decide that that's an epic, true, honest love, the kind of thing that is, you know, there aren't really words for it. It's more than the way he looks. It's more than the words that he says. It's just something that they have to feel on a chemical level. They have to just love each other. And having made that choice early on, you go, okay, well, that's just my given. Like, he, you know, I love him. And when he does this, he performs this act of honor, you know, it can be seen as pretty atrocious. It's a barroom fight, and a man dies as a result of it. But I think that we know that it's coming from his attempt to defend her honor, and it's coming from a noble place. So that only raises him in her esteem. The results of it happen to be horrible, fatal, but that he is willing to take these extremes for her sake in front of other people of his own status only furthers her love for him. And I think she's really willing to sacrifice. And she says, I'd give everything that I have to save him and to get him back.
Nice, nice. One other thing I'm sort of interested in about Bess is she sort of defies her station so much. She's a working class girl that falls in love with, you know, somebody above her station, and he falls in love with her. She dresses up like a man in this play. She, you know, eventually becomes a privateer, which is essentially just a pirate with a sense of nationalism. So, do you think Bess is a feminist, or do you think this is a feminist play? Would you say that?
If she is a feminist, I don't think she knows it. I mean, I think that this is just, again, it's one of those times when I felt like I had to make some decisions about her and just accept them. That no matter how patient I could imagine a person, Bess is more patient. No matter how cheerful I could imagine a person, Bess is more cheerful. And let that color the choices that I make on stage. And, you know, I don't think she's setting out to on any cause other than a personal cause. It's a personal cause against Ruffman, and it's a personal quest to get Spencer back, and she's willing to do whatever it takes. That those measures happen to be dressing up like a page in one scene and then as essentially a pirate in a later scene, I think that doesn't have to do so much with her thrust of feminism as much as, well, this is the necessity or the necessary measures to take. This is what must be done in my day and age. Dressed as a woman, I'm not going to get away with this, so this is what I'm going to do. And, you know, delightfully, Shakespeare uses this device all the time in his plays, and it's a great opportunity for female characters to have the same adventures that the male characters have. So, no, I'm not going to claim feminism here, but if that's what our audience picks up from it, I think that's just an added bonus. It makes the play even more current.
Right. Well, I guess in the end, that's what's so lovely about that character is she is patient, she is cheerful, she just, and then she just kind of does what she has to do in order to get the job done, which is
constant. I mean, they use the word honest and constant a lot. It's used over and over by herself and by the other characters. And I think that that's an important thing. She goes down in history because of her constancy in love, because she, above all things, stays true to this man over years, or over time anyway. I guess we don't know exactly how long it is. But over time and over all these other instances, she stays true and makes a decision that doesn't matter who comes to woo, her love sleeps with Spencer. And that's how she kind of becomes, that's her fame.
Nice, nice. Well, let's wrap this up with, let's do the same thing that Ralph likes to do with his, when he hosts these things. And just tell us about a line, each of you tell us about a line or a moment in this production that you just love doing. What's your favorite bit? And we'll start with Patrick.
Off the top of my head, my favorite Spencer moment is after his, he has a little soliloquy, and he has a nice soliloquy where he talks about wondering how anyone could be in love with life after they've experienced what he's experienced. And as that soliloquy wraps up, there, we see this kind of sword fight, a street brawl beginning on stage, and Spencer, in all his earnest goodness, says very simply to Captain Goodlack, "See, Captain, a fray towards. Let's, if we can, atone this difference." And in so doing is wounded mortally. But I love his good-hearted efforts to save the day.
Nice.
I think my favorite moment probably is what we alluded to earlier when I get to, as the text dictates, stride over Roughman. And in our rendition, I actually put one foot on James's buttocks and the other on his mid-back and stand triumphantly to say the words, "Now, Roughman, thou art blessed. This day thy life is saved. Look to the rest."
Indeed. I guess my favorite line in the play actually is not spoken by me or by anybody here. It's spoken by Mulla Sheikh near the end of the play. And Mulla Sheikh is an Islamic Moorish prince. And I guess I always feel like this has such a moment even for us today with all of our difficulties with religious difference and that. But Mulla Sheikh is this character who is swayed by Bess and who acts in highly civilized manner over and over again, and at one point he says that lust will not win out over virtue.
Yeah.
And the audience has applauded that line on several occasions when he says it. And so I think that I love when the audience applauds that line. I think, boy, they're really listening, they're really paying attention. And I think how great of Haywood to put this in the mouth of Mulla Sheikh. You know, it's really sort of reminding that, you know, Christians don't have any kind of cornered market on virtue and temperance and withholding for the sake of higher ideals. I thought that's pretty great. You know, for Roughman, he says, you know, "To spare my flesh and wound my fame, what is't?" I like that line, too, you know.
I like a lot of things that I say. I really like being in this play. I do think it's funny that Clem mistakes gelded for gilded and thinks that he's going to get honored by becoming what he thinks is awesome, but he doesn't know what it means, which is a eunuch, and goes off for that to happen to him, and then has to come back on, and Mulla Sheikh asks him if he's seen the Al-Khadavi, and Clem says, "Davy, call you him? He may be called Shavy. I'm sure he hath tickled my current commodity. No more of your cutting honor if you love me." I just think that's funny.
What a fantastic bit that Haywood just throws in right at the very end of the play. It's a little random and hilarious. I mean, I crack up every time. I've seen it, you know, 20 times now between rehearsals and all the times we've run this play, and it still just makes me laugh.
The joke has a keen edge.
A keen edge, very true. Yeah, what a delightful play. A super fun production. I hope all you out in the listening audience get a chance to see it. It's romantic, it's exciting, it's funny, and just overall, it's super fun. So thank you all for listening. Thank you all for participating.
We hope you have enjoyed this Blackfriars Backstage Pass. You can download these programs for free at AmericanShakespeareCenter.blogspot.com or subscribe to all of the ASC's podcasts through the iTunes Music Store podcast directory or through any number of other podcast listing sites. The Fair Maid of the West will be appearing on the stage of the Blackfriars Playhouse in Repertory with William Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew, Othello, and Henry IV Part II, along with John O'Keefe's Wild Oats, through November 28th. Tickets for all five 2010 fall season productions are available by calling the American Shakespeare Center box office toll-free at 1-877-MUCH-ADO or by going online at AmericanShakespeareCenter.com. I'm your Backstage Pass producer, Bill Gordon. Special thanks to recording engineer Sam Kugler. Once again, thank you for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you at the Blackfriars Playhouse.